Hitler was enraged. As far as he was concerned, the episode was a frivolous publicity stunt, staged at a time when every man was needed for the main advance. Army Group A's commander, Field Marshal Liszt, fell victim to Hitler's dissatisfaction on 6 September. The latter, signalling his growing distrust of his generals, took temporary charge of Army Group A himself from his headquarters in the western Ukraine. He began multitasking to extremes as he sought to conduct the campaign in no fewer than 4 different capacities, as Army Group Commander, Head of the Army, Commander-in-Chief of the Wehrmacht, and ultimately as Führer. In November, Hitler found a permanent replacement for Liszt in the shape of the immensely capable Panzer Commander, General von Kleist. But overall, from this point on, Hitler himself led the entire southern campaign in an increasingly restrictive and destructive manner. With Stalingrad and the Volga now the principal German targets, by mid-August, Army Group B comprised the German 2nd and 6th Armies, the 4th Panzer Army, the Hungarian 2nd Army, and the newly arrived Italian 8th Army. When the 4th Panzer Army arrived, together with powerful air support, the 6th Army was finally able to attack Stalingrad directly. Direct attack was the only option where Stalingrad was concerned, because it straddled a great length along both banks of the Volga, and the Soviets held the Volga's left bank and its hinterland, the Germans could not besiege it properly. But the Soviets ratcheted up their efforts against the German advance, rushing in 4 additional armies. The 4th Panzer Army had to fight off Soviet counterattacks north and south of Stalingrad and defend the left wing of the German advance along the River Don to the northwest. In a particularly ominous development, the OKH was already needing to throw in satellite armies to plug that particular flank. The Red Army also counterattacked over the Don, seizing a vital bridgehead that the Germans could not shift. Though the Germans were advancing on Stalingrad, their position was already precarious and their progress agonizing. Typical was the Battle of Kalach on the River Don, of which Colonel Adam later wrote, "A great German victory was proclaimed with blasts of fanfares. It did not mention that we had to pay a high cost in men and material." According to Adam, many companies of the 376th Infantry Division had fighting strength of only 25 men. Things were a little better in the 44th and 384th Infantry Divisions, but companies with fighting strength of between 35 and 40 men gave no cause for optimism. 14 Panzer Corps tried to break into Stalingrad, but Soviet counterattacks during the second half of August prevented the 6th Army from reinforcing it. The 16th Panzer Division eventually had to break out back the way it had come, but not before it had suffered 500 casualties per day during the last week of August. The Germans' failure to capture Stalingrad on this particular occasion gave the Soviets real breathing space, which they used to reinforce the troops in the city extensively. A Soviet counterattack before Stalingrad on 6 September was poorly coordinated, but gave the Soviet 62nd Army further time to prepare its defense of the city. And by evacuating the bulk of Stalingrad's population only at the last minute, the Red Army was able to enlist massive civilian help in building the city's defenses. Most of the civilians who remained in those parts of the city that the Germans overran could expect a grim fate, albeit less grim than the one Hitler initially envisaged for them. On 31 August, Hitler announced that he wanted the city destroyed and its male population exterminated. 3 days later, however, the Chief of Staff of Army Group B instructed the 6th Army that all civilians, including the men, were to be evacuated. The reason seems to have been economic rather than moral, their potential as a voluntary or, if necessary, coerced labor force. The 6th Army retained about 4,000 civilians for various tasks, and General Quartermaster Wagner was made responsible for those who could not work, and for accommodating them in villages and collective farms west of the River Don. But so pressured was the Germans' transport system that most of the non-working civilians were eventually dumped on the Kalmuck steppe. Here they could expect to perish by winter at the latest. Eventually, the 6th Army's own increasingly straitened supply situation prevented it from feeding the civilians who remained in its part of the city. While the German Army's treatment of Stalingrad civilians was not an attempt to emulate the hunger strategy then, its poor provisioning led to massive human misery. In September, 48 Panzer Corps occupied the banks of the Volga south of Stalingrad, and with this blocked the city to the Red Army forces to the south. Over the next few days, the Germans took most of the old city, but made slow progress in the north. The Germans captured more districts during the second half of September, but at huge cost and an almost snail-like pace. While urban fighting is perhaps the most grueling type for any attacking force, for the attackers at Stalingrad, principally Paulus's 6th Army, it was grueling almost beyond words. On 29 July, Stalin had issued Order Number 227, forbidding the Red Army to take a single step backwards. In Stalingrad itself, the Red Army executed 13,500 of its own soldiers in the space of a few weeks. Yet fear of their own side's ferocious discipline was not the most important reason why Soviet troops held on in Stalingrad. The German strength had been seriously ground down during their advance upon the city, and once the attack on Stalingrad proper had begun, Paulus was never able to concentrate the full strength of his remaining force on the city itself. His 7 and 14 corps were tied down by ferocious Soviet counterattacks north of the city, when they should have been reinforcing the German attack inside it. The Soviet forces inside the city now comprised the 62nd Army, part of the 64th Army, and the 16th Air Army. This force was nowhere near strong enough to drive the Germans out of Stalingrad, but this was not the Soviets' intention. Zhukov had persuaded Stalin that the city bearing his name should be held by the minimum force necessary, while the Red Army gathered the bulk of its available strength in the rear for a well-timed major counteroffensive. The Soviet defenders inside Stalingrad also held on because of their sheer tenacity and resourcefulness, and the ability of their principal commander, General Vasily Chuikov, to harness those qualities. Chuikov was a consummate defensive commander. For one thing, by placing his front line as close as possible to that of the Germans, he made it harder for them to call up their own artillery and air support for fear of hitting their own troops. Chuikov's tactic of hugging the Germans also kept them in a state of constant nervous tension, and Soviet night attacks and sniper fire wore down their numbers further. The experience of having to fight the enemy so close up was described by Private Willy Hoffmann of the 94th Infantry Division in his diary entry of 13 September. "A bad date. Our battalion was very unlucky. The Katyushas inflicted heavy losses this morning, 27 killed and 50 wounded. The Russians fight with the desperation of wild beasts. They won't allow themselves to be taken prisoner, but instead let you come up close and then they throw grenades." The Soviets riddled much of the city with mines and booby traps, as well as with soldiers. Separating panzers from the German infantry enabled the Soviets to pick off isolated panzers with concealed anti-tank guns. The Soviets did not just defend buildings indiscriminately, but also selected particular buildings for defense with anti-tank obstacles and fields of fire cleared around them. They also sought not only to defend buildings, but also to retake them. To do this, they made coordinated use of three types of squad. A covering squad would provide supporting fire for the assault squad that attacked the actual building, with a reinforcement squad held in reserve. On one occasion, an especially resourceful unit, the assault group of the 45th Rifle Division, moved an entire 120mm howitzer piece by piece through a building, then reassembled it and fired it at point-blank range to blast through the wall of the building they were aiming to storm. Targeted counterattacks such as this were especially effective when the Soviets used them to throw the Germans off balance just before the Germans themselves were about to launch a major attack. Reconnaissance patrols that brought back prisoners for interrogation helped the Soviets to pinpoint when and where the Germans were going to attack. The defenders also made full use of Stalingrad sewers and interlocking underground cellars to move across the city, sending reinforcements where they were needed and springing up, mole-like, to surprise the Germans in the rear. Private Willy Hoffmann's diary entry for 26 September fumed, "You can't see them. They hide in the buildings and basements and strike at us from all sides, even from the rear. Such barbarians to use gangster tactics against us. Russian soldiers have suddenly reappeared in a sector which we occupied 2 days ago, and the battle has begun all over again. Red Army infantry weaponry was straightforward, cheap, and above all, durable. Indeed, it proved so effective that German troops often preferred captured Soviet submachine guns to their own models. The city's defenders had further formidable technical backup from artillery, not just Katyushas, on the Volga's eastern bank. Furthermore, their air support was now radio-coordinated. Artillery cover, together with the Volga's steep banks, enabled the Soviets to bring enough reinforcements across the river despite attacks from the Luftwaffe. That the Germans managed to batter their way forward at all was thanks to the further improvements they had made in their combined arms urban warfare methods. Their infantry was, if anything, more formidably equipped than ever, with grenades, heavy infantry weapons, and flamethrowers. The latter were not just fearful weapons psychologically, they were also especially effective against bunkers because they burned up all the oxygen inside. But in Stalingrad, the attackers suffered acute supply shortages, most grievously in fuel and ammunition. For the Germans in Stalingrad stood at the very end of an extremely precarious supply line. Several hundred trains were held up at the start of October by partisan activity, Soviet air attacks, storms, and coal shortages, and two of the main railway lines running in Stalingrad's direction anyway ended west of the Don. Horse-drawn transportation was under threat from the environment itself. On the dry, open steppe, the land could supply neither drinking water nor food, and in October, 6,400 of the Sixth Army's horses died, compared with 3,400 the previous month. In October, General Paulus dispatched all supposedly dispensable horses, barring those necessary for pulling artillery and heavy weapons, or for medical services, to the army area west of the Don, the better to provide them with fodder. As Colonel Adam later observed, "This was a risky business. The divisions lost their essential transport, but what else can one do if one was not to leave the animals to starve? That these measures might later contribute to our starving thousands of German soldiers, no one considered at the time." Such were the logistical bottlenecks and the mushrooming casualties that medical services, never the German army's highest priority, were also under exceptional strain. For instance, two of the divisions fighting in Stalingrad did not have a single field hospital between them. A particularly grim comment on the Sixth Army's logistical situation was that it had to ban its men from fishing with hand grenades in the River Don because of the injuries they were causing. And the army that was having to contend with all this and with hellish urban fighting had already been whittled down before it even reached Stalingrad. The experience of the 24th Panzer Division highlights what this meant for the units at the sharp end. Both its Panzergrenadier, mechanized infantry, regiments were burned out, losing over 50% of their combat strength. The panzers now often had to cooperate with non-mechanized infantry, troops for whom combined arms operations with panzers were unfamiliar territory. The panzers themselves were highly vulnerable to Soviet fire in the rubble-strewn cityscape, so much so that the division eventually viewed them as useless. Landscape problems like house rubble, bomb damage, closed streets, minefields, tank traps and blocks limit the mobility and the observation ability of the tanks so much that the employment of tank units in urban fighting is on principle to be avoided. Tellingly, one thing the division was not anxious to avoid was civilian deaths. If its troops destroyed Red Army positions that were also protecting civilians, then this was of no consequence. Here, too, then, the dictates of perceived military necessity had further hardened German conduct since the urban fighting in Warsaw in 1939. German communications in the city were also regularly severed, just as at Dnipropetrovsk the previous year. "All connections with the front line were broken," reported the 208th Infantry Regiment of an attack on a metallurgy factory on 23 and 24 October. "All lines were shot. Overcoming these interruptions was as good as impossible." In such conditions, it was more important than ever for troop leaders to show initiative, but even this could only compensate so far. The Germans nicknamed the urban fighting in Stalingrad Rattenkrieg, the War of the Rats. They would learn hard lessons from it that they would put to good use during their own defensive battles later in the war. For now, however, it was they who suffered most. While the Sixth Army's men died in Stalingrad in droves, the battle was precipitating a wider crisis in the OKH. On 24 September, General Hulder resigned as Chief of Staff. He was increasingly alarmed at Operation Blue's proliferating objectives, conveniently forgetting his own part in selecting them, and particularly at Hitler's mismanagement of the campaign. Hulder was now falling victim to Hitler's excoriating mockery, as the dictator needled him for the supposedly comfortable existence he had led as a staff officer during the First World War. In late August, Hitler had publicly humiliated Hulder when the general recommended that Army Group Center withdraw to a more defensible line. "What can you, who sat in the same chair in the First World War too, tell me about the troops, Herr Hulder, you who don't even wear the black insignia of the wounded?" Some weeks later, Colonel General Friedrich Fromm, Chief of Army Procurement and Commander of the Replacement Army, also fell foul of the Führer when he prognosticated gloomily about Germany's long-term prospects in the war. In this atmosphere, Lieutenant General Kurt Zeitzler, Hulder's successor as Army Chief of Staff, had a thankless task. Zeitzler was an ardent admirer of Hitler, but he too would try on numerous occasions over the next 2 years to prevent or ameliorate the Führer's more senseless commands. The effort would eventually drive him to a nervous breakdown. That lay in the future. The most significant point about Zeitzler's appointment in September 1942 was that he was not a staff officer, but a former frontline officer. Here, then, was Hitler telling all his staff officers, not just Hulder, exactly what he thought of them compared with an officer who, for Hitler, embodied the far more essential command qualities found at the front. On 1 October, Hitler made an appointment even more pivotal for its transformative effect upon the officer corps. He appointed his adjutant, Rudolf Schmundt, now a major general, to head the Army Personnel Office. Schmundt's brief was to enact measures designed further to elevate character as the leading determinant of promotion, and thus to expand the transformation that Hitler had initiated in the wake of the frontline crisis of the previous winter. Hitler rapidly followed up Schmundt's appointment by announcing that any officer who leads his men successfully against the enemy and who shows himself suitable will be promoted to a rank on the level at which he is performing. He also decried the notion of a steady-going system of promotion, which he believed went against the principles of leadership and achievement to which the Wehrmacht must adhere dutifully in its highest responsibility for the final victory. The effects this policy would have upon the officer corps would reveal themselves during 1943. Meanwhile, regardless of the rate at which the fighting in Stalingrad was chewing them up, Hitler continually ordered German reinforcements into the meat grinder from elsewhere along the southern front. He kept insisting that capturing the city would protect Army Group A's rear, and also that it would sever the Red Army's vital supply artery along the Volga. In addition, he maintained that the Sixth Army could supply itself better in the city than if it withdrew onto the steppe to the west. These strategic and logistical arguments were not Hitler's main motive, however. His desire to take the city had become an obsession, and the principal reason was prestige. By the end of October, Nazi propaganda had hammered on about Stalingrad so much that, according to the SD's regular morale reports, the German population was fixated on it. Even more importantly, Hitler was consumed by the idea that capturing the city named after the Soviet dictator would strike Soviet morale a mortal blow. Stalin and Zhukov were, of course, delighted to feed Hitler's obsession, for it weakened the Axis forces everywhere else in the south and boosted the prospects for the Red Army counteroffensive they were planning. In mid-October, the Germans attacked again in the north of Stalingrad, through the factories of the Industrial Belt. The Soviet defenders found their backs to the Volga, and the areas contested became even smaller, while the fighting grew ever fiercer. As one German soldier described it, "The front is a corridor between burned-out rooms. It is the thin ceiling between two floors. Help comes from nearby buildings via fire escapes and chimneys. There is ceaseless struggle from morning until night. From floor to floor we bombard each other with grenades amid explosions, clouds of dust and smoke, heaps of mortar, floods of blood, fragments of furniture and fragments of human beings." Paulus then sent the 14th Panzer Division and the 389th Infantry Division into the factory district. The two formations managed to capture most of the factory district by late October, but at hideous cost to themselves. Meanwhile, the new Don and Southwestern fronts northwest of Stalingrad launched further counterattacks north and south of the city. By mid-November, there were no longer enough regiments, let alone divisions, with which to reinforce the Sixth Army, and a now desperate Paulus resorted to cannibalizing his own divisions. He separated off their engineer battalions and hurled them into action with massive air support. However, the Luftwaffe's aerial bombardment proved self-defeating. For the most part, the Soviet defenders simply hid in the cellars and sewers while it took place, then emerged into even more rubble in which they could hide and fight. Paulus's misuse of the Luftwaffe was not the only serious error he made during the battle. Another was his failure to assemble a proper mobile reserve. He was far from incompetent, but he was out of his element. He had assumed command of the Sixth Army in December 1941, when his predecessor, Field Marshal von Reichenau, had taken short-lived command of Army Group South. Prior to this, he had been the Deputy Chief of Operations at the OKH. He was a highly capable staff officer, if also a somewhat diffident one, as his failure to voice his concerns about the feasibility of Operation Barbarossa had shown. But as far as field commands went, he had never commanded anything bigger than a battalion. There was one respect in which Paulus was an improvement on Reichenau. He genuinely believed the Germans were more likely to defeat the Soviet Union if they treated the occupied population more considerately. But restraint was not the most essential command characteristic in Stalingrad. If Paulus lacked much of his predecessor's brutality, he also lacked much of his assertiveness. Lieutenant General Balck, who had served with Paulus during the interwar years and frequently encountered him at the OKH, considered him a noble and honest individual, but also shy and sensitive, and that in Stalingrad, as the weak man that he was, he remained true to what he had always done. He presented facts, asked for decisions, and then turned them into orders for others to execute. Meanwhile, Army Group A's debilitated advance slowed over the course of the autumn. It was firmly among the highest peaks of the Caucasus proper, the most difficult natural terrain of the entire Eastern campaign, as the soldiers' letters attest. "I'm sitting in the deepest Caucasus," wrote Helmut D. on 5 September, as the 4th Mountain Division drove on Sukhumi. "We've fought nicely up until now, but at the moment the Russian is rather strong. Mountain fighting needs time, and the supplies have to be hauled by pack animal up the mountain, down the mountain. The forest here is really primeval. There are wild boar, eagles, and bears. Countless huge rotting trees lie on the ground. It's thick undergrowth, so we can only advance along the paths." A mid-October report by the commander of the 198th Infantry Division, crawling towards Tupase on the Black Sea coast, described the fighting. "The storm of infantry and pioneers breaks loose, supported by an exterminating fire of artillery and a gigantic hail of bombing from the Luftwaffe. But in this forest area, visibility is poor, and the best prepared infantry and pioneer attack is vulnerable to being surprised. It is the attack's power and tenacity that must ultimately force the decision. Mostly, then, the infantryman is on his own in this harsh and unfamiliar mountain battle. With necessary effort through parching heat, he has to hack his way through the thickets, often with entrenching tool in hand, always observed by the lurking, devious enemy. Rockfalls and crags have to be overcome through fire. The attack leads to the steepest slope, over thin ridges with huge falls either side, such that hardly any group can move forward. Enemy machine gun, anti-tank gun, and grenade launcher positions must be overrun, and the bitterly resisting enemy overcome man to man." A report by the 4th Mountain Division described how the terrain made it harder both for the troops to fight and for the rear to supply them. The troops were also vulnerable because they relied so much on horse-drawn transport. For not only was the horse's supply of feed breaking down, the mountainous terrain lacked proper grazing land. As the horses weakened and died, the division could no longer move its heavy weapons and artillery. In early November, the 1st Panzer Army made a final heave in the direction of the oil center of Grozny and the Caspian Sea. The execrable weather assailed both sides. The 198th Infantry Division took particular heed of the rain, which was of a special nature in the mountains. The rain comes down in torrents, for the heights are mainly in the clouds. It pours down and lasts all day and night. There were no villages in the division's area, and so the troops were fully exposed. The mud disrupted supply further, just as it had the previous autumn. At least, in contrast with the previous winter, the troops were being supplied with specialist winter gear as temperatures plummeted. By now, as in Stalingrad, the Germans and Soviets were fighting over diminishing spaces of territory, and their tightly packed formations made perfect targets for each other's aircraft. The Germans' reserves ran out before those of the Red Army, and on 6 November the Red Army counterattacked. On 11 November, wrote Oberjäger Georg S. of the 4th Mountain Division, all our platoon commanders and all but two of our section commanders were put out of action. I was shot through the upper right arm with a machine pistol. I bandaged myself and carried on. In the evening, after we had repelled two Russian counterattacks, I went to the medical station to get taken care of. The doctor wanted to send me to the field hospital, but I went on my own volition back to my comrades, who needed a leader and who were already so few anyway. Given the distance Army Group A had come, the environment it had fought over, and the loss of half its strength to other sectors of the front, it had achieved a remarkable feat in getting this far. But by early November, the German offensive into the Caucasus had come to an end. Within weeks, the Germans would be retreating from the region, for events around Stalingrad were about to imperil the whole German position in the south. Colonel Adam described Stalingrad's shattered cityscape as it appeared to him in mid-November. Seeing the devastated state of the city for the first time from bombing and close-quarter fighting, Schiller's words came to me, "Horror lives in the empty window frames." By 15 November, the 6th Army's combat divisions were short of 115,000 men. Between July and November, the German Army had lost more than 1,600 tanks. That said, the Red Army had suffered at least 1.2 million casualties in the fighting along the Voronezh and Stalingrad axes between the end of June and the middle of November, compared with Axis losses of about 200,000, and the Soviets had also lost 4,800 tanks. Figures such as this highlight just how formidable a force the German army still was. In Stalingrad itself, the 62nd Army was down to less than a full division in strength. But while the Soviets could still sustain even these phenomenal losses, the Germans could no longer sustain theirs. Above all, at Stalingrad, as in the Caucasus, the Germans had failed to achieve their key objectives, and now winter was coming. As the fighting in Stalingrad sucked in ever more German formations, not only Army Group A suffered. The front line either side of Stalingrad was stripped bare of German units and manned by second-rate Allied and satellite armies, the Italian 8th Army, Hungarian 2nd Army, and Romanian 3rd and 4th Armies. These might have performed their defensive role adequately were it not for the sheer size of their front. They also lacked artillery and anti-tank guns, and the Germans gave them no air support. The Italian, Hungarian, and Romanian armies were thus perilously overextended, positively inviting the kind of Red Army breakthrough that could easily encircle the 6th Army itself. Zhukov continued to indulge Hitler's obsession with capturing Stalingrad, ensuring that Chuikov always received enough reinforcements while amassing powerful forces for a counteroffensive. Although Hitler did not accept the danger to the 6th Army's flanks, several of his generals did, but Zeitzler was the only one who raised the alarm. It is unclear how far German commanders regarded the prospect of a Soviet winter offensive with a resigned fatalism, or how far they believed they could somehow weather any storm. The latter, however, is suggested by German military intelligence's continued failure to grasp the extent of the Red Army's ability to replenish old units and raise new ones. The Soviets' preparation for the offensive suffered shortages in effective communications and trucks, such that some of the forces earmarked for it and some of their supplies arrived late at their jumping-off points. But by biding their time, planning the operation meticulously and building up resources at least to the necessary level, Red Army leaders were already showing that they had learned vital lessons from the previous winter. The Red Army was able to amass more than 1 million men and over 1,500 tanks for the operation. This was a force that was formidable not just in numbers, but also in fighting power. Red Army training had improved markedly since 1941. Among other things, the Red Army now employed a system of replacement training regiments organizing basic training in the rear. It also used a system of reinforcement that was as ruthless as it was effective. Divisions fought at the front line until they had been thoroughly ground down. They were then withdrawn and replenished. This system precipitated enormous losses, but also ensured that the Red Army got maximum use of its divisions. But the most dramatic changes, fueled by a prodigious armaments production drive, were taking place within the Red Army's mechanized force. In early July, the Red Army had established 4 tank armies. A tank army was equivalent to a panzer corps, and emulated the Germans' combined arms approach by grouping tank divisions with a rifle division and other infantry and support units. By September 1942, the Red Army had formed 24 tank corps within its new tank armies. Each Soviet tank corps was about the size of a 1941 German panzer division, and was composed overwhelmingly of T-34s. Moreover, a new generation of senior Red Army commanders was emerging. Many of the incompetent commanders of 1941 had been sacked, and indeed a few executed. Taking their place were many younger officers. Some proved equally incompetent, but some matured into highly effective commanders. Others, including Zhukov, had been recalled from exile commanding far-flung outposts. Furthermore, following the failure of the Soviet counterattack of winter 1941-1942 and the disastrous Kharkov offensive, Stalin was at last more prepared to listen to advice and give his new competent senior commanders free rein. The officer corps as a whole placed new emphasis on professionalism and merit, and officers enjoyed greater status as limits were placed on the power of communist functionaries within the Red Army. Operation Uranus was launched on 19 November in wintry conditions against the especially weakly held sector of the Axis front line north and south of Stalingrad. The lessons learned from it would help the Soviets eventually to launch a successful major offensive against the Germans themselves. The operation's most immediate effect was to swing the pendulum in the south firmly against the Axis and place the 6th Army in grave and immediate danger of being cut off. Yet Paulus obeyed Hitler unquestioningly when, on 22 November, the dictator forbade the 6th Army to withdraw west to escape the Soviet pincers. The following day, the 6th Army was encircled completely. Peter Wunschel, an ex-journalist who was now an intelligence officer in the 384th Infantry Division, saw disaster ahead. "We are shutting ourselves in of our own free will." The core of this information, the full significance of this sentence, struck me like a screaming headline. Hitler readily accepted assurances from Goering and from Luftwaffe Chief of Staff Hans Jeschonek that the Luftwaffe could keep the 6th Army supplied by air. Airlifts had worked the previous winter with the Demyansk pocket, but Goering and Jeschonek had felt pressured by Hitler into giving these assurances, and misjudged the obstacles involved in keeping Stalingrad relieved. To start with, the 6th Army was far larger than the body of troops that the Luftwaffe had relieved in the pockets of the previous winter. The Luftwaffe's fuel and aircraft were already overstretched as it tried to support German ground forces across the south. Because Operation Uranus had overrun the Germans' forward airfields near Stalingrad, the Luftwaffe hastily had to construct new makeshift ones. It also faced the strength of the VVS and of Soviet anti-aircraft batteries. Even if they got through, German aircraft had limited options for landing within the pocket. Indeed, after the Soviets overran its remaining working airfields within range in mid-January, all that remained to the Luftwaffe was the even less reliable method of airdrops. The effects of the shortages were felt very quickly, as Major Werner Beumelberg of the Luftwaffe later recalled. Some divisions still had horses, which they had to share with others. Little by little, the horses ended up in the field kitchens. Every day that provisions were not replenished made the situation worse, but the army's needs could never be met. It was living from hand to mouth. In fact, every day it was living beyond its means, and it was easy to calculate at what point there would be nothing left at all. It was not only the leadership of the Luftwaffe that fed Hitler's belief that Stalingrad could be held, but also Field Marshal von Manstein. Hitler recalled Manstein from the Leningrad front in late November and appointed him to command a new formation, Army Group Don, which was charged with relieving the Sixth Army. One of Manstein's first acts as commander of Army Group Don, and his first mistake, was to signal to Paulus on 24 November, "We will do all we can to get you out. In the meantime, it is imperative that Sixth Army, whilst holding firm on the Volga and North Fronts in accordance with the Führer's orders, stands by strong forces as soon as possible, in order to force a supply route towards the southwest, if necessary, at least temporarily." This ambiguous order left Paulus unclear as to whether he should actually be preparing his troops for a breakout to meet any upcoming relief attempt. Manstein can also be criticized on several further counts. He failed properly to assess the Luftwaffe's actual ability to keep the Sixth Army supplied. He also overestimated the forces that would be available to him in any attempt to break through to Stalingrad. His own army group's intelligence then underestimated the size of the Soviet forces facing him. Manstein might have been better off calling upon Paulus to break out immediately. Though Paulus was not the strongest of characters, Manstein might have helped fortify his resolve by taking personal responsibility himself for any breakout attempt. It would have helped if Manstein had flown into the pocket to assess the situation there himself. Instead, he sent in his unflappable chief of staff, Colonel Theodor Busse. Busse came back out, assuring Manstein, "It's a bad business, sir, but we'll manage somehow," and fortified the field marshal's unwarranted optimism further. In turn, Manstein now fortified Hitler's conviction that the Sixth Army could and must stay put, and that any attempt to relieve it must only be with the aim of holding open a corridor through which to supply it. On 28 November, Zeitzler told Manstein that Hitler had decreed, "Stalingrad is to be held with all means." In other words, the aim was not to allow the Sixth Army to break out to the west, but for a relief force to open up a supply and reinforcement corridor to the west, and thus enable it to stay put. On the other hand, the Sixth Army would have needed time to reposition itself for a swift breakout anyway. By the time it might have been able to break out, its own fuel and ammunition situation was likely to have worsened and the Soviet ring around Stalingrad strengthened. Under those circumstances, the Sixth Army would have had to make a breakout attempt on foot and risk being annihilated by the Soviets on the open steppe. Manstein also had to consider the potential consequences of what might happen to the rest of the front if the Sixth Army was destroyed. As he wrote in his diary, "So now it's not only about Sixth Army, but rather whether we can hold the southern wing during the winter." In short, it may already have been too late for any breakout attempt in any case. None of this is to defend either Manstein or Paulus, but rather to point out that the situation may by now have become too intractable for any course of action to have averted the battle's eventual outcome. In any case, on 12 December, having had to spend 2 weeks scraping together such reinforcements as were available and fighting off the Red Army in order to secure suitable jumping-off positions for a relief attempt, Manstein attacked the strengthening Soviet ring around Stalingrad with Operation Winter Storm. But because the Soviets were threatening a further attack in the direction of Rostov, only one armored corps, the 57 Panzer Corps, could be spared for the operation. And even this had limited artillery and air support. In the event, by 23 December, 57 Panzer Corps had got within 40 kilometers, 25 miles, of Stalingrad, but Manstein was unable to get Paulus to assemble forces for a mini-breakout to the west that would have opened up a corridor to the relieving force. Manstein repeated his mistake of November by sending in his intelligence officer, Major Eismann, to assess the situation in the pocket, rather than flying in and trying to fortify Paulus's resolve himself. It would be easy to blame Paulus for dithering. However, so poor by now was the Sixth Army's state of supply, and so strong the Soviet ring around the city, that the Sixth Army was probably unable to break out in the limited way Manstein wished. Eventually, the 2nd Guards Army, a formation of whose presence Manstein's intelligence contained no inkling, stopped 57 Panzer Corps from getting any further. Then, on 23 December, one of 57 Corps' divisions had to be transferred north to plug a gap created following the destruction of the Italian 8th Army. The remnants of Army Group B and Army Group Don at least managed to spare Army Group A the same fate as the 6th Army by preventing the Soviets from seizing Rostov. But this was the end of 57 Corps' effort in Winter Storm. Colonel von Mellenthin later wrote that of the heroism of the men of the 57th Panzer Corps in this vain attempt to rescue their comrades at Stalingrad, it is unnecessary to say more. By 26th December, the Corps was almost non-existent. It had literally died on its feet. Hitler now hoped to string out the 6th Army's death agonies in order to tie down Soviet armies for as long as possible so as to help stabilize the situation in the rest of the South. Manstein himself later wrote, "It was the valiant 6th Army which, by loyally fighting on to the last, snatched the palm of annihilating victory against the German southern wing from the enemy's hand. Paulus felt bound by the shackles of obedience from surrendering." As Colonel Adam later wrote, "Paulus was through and through a disciplined and obedient soldier. He would rather perish with his army than become a mutineer. To me, inwardly, General Paulus represented a superior and humane being. I was very sorry for him in this deep conflict." But the exhaustion of the 6th Army's supplies now condemned it to a lingering death. By mid-December, according to Colonel Adam, it was already eating its horses, and even then, hunger increased and bored even deeper into the bowels of the surrounded. On 15 December, the bread ration had to be reduced to 100 grams. Two slices of bread per day, a thin soup of horse flesh, and some cups of herb tea or malt tea was what the soldier had to fight and live on and withstand frost, snow, and storm. At Christmas, while some well-connected officers were able to celebrate in style, soldiers elsewhere in the pocket faced starvation. As there was no shortage of human corpses, some men in Wilhelm Bayer's unit contemplated cannibalism, even, if necessary, on their own body parts. Even those accustomed to hunger, who knew how much pain the disappearance of the last small cushions of fat on the toes or elsewhere cause, seriously consider taking this action in defiance of orders. In turn, the 6th Army heaped further misery on the civilian population in the pocket. To deny shelter to the advancing Soviets or to make way for German defenses, it destroyed numerous small settlements around the city. By 10 January 1943, cold, hunger, and infection had reduced the 6th Army to half its original strength. Joachim Wieder, one of the 6th Army's soldiers, described the state to which they had been brought. There were emaciated figures among them, muffled in coats, rags, pitiful wrecks painfully dragging themselves forwards, leaning on sticks and hobbling on frozen feet, wrapped in wisps of straw and strips of blankets. Drifting along through the snowstorm, this was the wreck of the 6th Army that had advanced to the Volga during the summer, so confident of victory. That same day, the Red Army launched its final offensive to destroy the Stalingrad pocket. Because it had had to fight off winter storm, getting to this point had taken 8 weeks. Moreover, the Soviets were unaware that they had a pocket of 270,000 troops to clear, rather than the 91,000 they believed they had encircled, and the task therefore took 3 weeks. They commenced their attack with overwhelming artillery fire, followed by massed infantry attacks supported by large mechanized forces. There were relatively few casualties. So miserable now was the 6th Army's condition that it probably rendered the Soviets' task easier. "What order should I give to my troops?" Paulus asked Hitler on 29 January, with fighting almost at an end. On 30 January, Hitler sought to bolster Paulus's resolve by promoting him to field marshal. He reasoned that rather than surrender and become Germany's first ever field marshal to go into captivity, Paulus would do the honorable thing and shoot himself. He was forgetting, however, that Paulus was a Roman Catholic. Paulus surrendered the following day, and Hitler reacted with a rage spectacular even by his standards. "This hurts me so much," he ranted, "because the heroism of so many soldiers is nullified by one characterless weakling. What is life? Life is the nation. The individual must die anyway. Accompanying Paulus into captivity were the remaining soldiers of the Sixth Army who were still alive within the pocket. But the Soviets, like the Germans the previous winter, had not made proper provision for taking vast numbers of prisoners. Only around 5,000 of the 91,000 men who went into captivity would live to see Germany again. Of those who did not, the great majority perished when a typhus epidemic ravaged the prison camps the following winter. The last word goes to one of the Sixth Army's own soldiers, whose final letter, presumably written to a wife or sweetheart, conveys both misery at the conditions and loss of faith in Hitler. "I love you, and you love me, and so you should know the truth. The truth is the knowledge of the hardest struggle in a hopeless situation. Misery, hunger, cold, resignation, doubt, despair, and horrible dying. I'm not cowardly, just sad that I can give no greater proof of my bravery than to die for such pointlessness, not to say crime." By 2 February, the day on which the final specks of resistance in the pocket were obliterated, the Stalingrad campaign had cost the Germans 300,000 men and the Allied and satellite armies 655,000. With these losses, not to mention the peril in which the defeat had now placed the German armies in the Caucasus, Stalingrad was a defeat the scale of which could not be concealed from the German people. Yet the losses the German army had suffered during the Battle of Stalingrad itself were not the worst of it. Worse still was the attrition rate it had suffered since the start of Operation Blue. The Germans had already lost enough equipment for 50 divisions between the launch of Barbarossa and that of Blue. Indeed, by the time Blue began, such losses were already locking the army into a downward spiral, rendering it increasingly incapable of achieving ambitious objectives. Then, between the launch of Blue and the end of the fighting in Stalingrad and the Caucasus in January and February 1943, it lost enough equipment for another 45 divisions. In one respect, this rate of destruction was less catastrophic than it may at first appear, for by early 1943 the German war economy was again making good the losses in equipment. For instance, between the beginning of July 1942 and the end of January 1943, the Germans lost over 1,900 armored fighting vehicles, including perhaps 1,500 on the Eastern Front. Yet during the same period, nearly 2,800 armored fighting vehicles went into service. Against this, however, was an inescapable truth. The Germans were facing a Soviet opponent, and indeed an Allied coalition, whose economic capacity was far greater than theirs. In this new reality, even a net gain of 900 armored fighting vehicles was the kind of figure that increasingly condemned the German army to a situation of running not so much to stand still as merely to lag behind by less yawning margins. The Battle of Stalingrad was not the most important turning point of the German army's war. That distinction goes to December 1941, a month that had seen both the first failure of a major German campaign and the entry of the United States into the war. But with 300,000 German troops lost, and their comrades in the Caucasus now facing the same choice of retreat or annihilation, the Battle of Stalingrad was the dramatic crowning point of 7 months of campaigning that had inflicted catastrophic losses upon the German army for no perceptible gain. Perhaps even more importantly, it provided the Red Army and the Soviet people with an emphatic, morale-boosting signal that they not only could withstand the German onslaught, but also repel and destroy it. Much credit for the Germans' defeat in the South during 1942 and at the start of 1943 should go to the Soviet Union's increasing industrial output and to the phenomenal resilience and resourcefulness of the Red Army's troops both in Stalingrad and across the South more widely. Credit should also go to organizational changes the Red Army had made. It was still far from being the unstoppable force it would become by 1944, but its improved tactics, organization, leadership, and material strength had all enabled it to begin steadily but surely to approach that state. The German army's execution of the Southern Campaign betrayed the constraints that afflicted it following its failure in 1941. Spectacular successes could still be achieved, as at Kharkov and in the Crimea, against a Red Army whose operational skills remained inferior to its own for much of 1942, and the army's performance in the Caucasus exemplified the immense feats of which the German soldier was still capable. Yet the Germans' narrow military achievements brought no lasting strategic benefit, and were bought at an appalling and, more importantly, unsustainable cost. They also relied excessively upon that National Socialist conception of warfare that placed paramount importance on grit, determination, and willpower, qualities that might get the German soldier far, but not far enough. The effort needed to attain the full set of Operation Blue's ever more ambitious goals, and to take large numbers of Soviet prisoners, was beyond an army operating with straitened means at the very ends of singularly precarious supply lines. That the campaign failed on such a catastrophic scale can be blamed upon its leading figures, Hitler primarily, with his debilitating micromanagement and his all-consuming obsession with Stalingrad, but also Halder, Paulus, Manstein, and Göring. These commanders mishandled key phases of the fighting or logistics, or, in Halder's case, were complicit in overloading Operation Blue with additional demands. Fueling many of the general's miscalculations was an improving but still defective German military intelligence service, but the greater blame lay in the general's excessive confidence in their own professional abilities and those of their troops. Perhaps even more fundamentally, the German army was less capable of conducting a war-winning offensive in 1942 than it had been in 1941. This failure can in turn be traced directly back to its failure to defeat the Red Army a year earlier. Now, for a growing number of soldiers, the immediate future was signified by the degradation and demodernization already being experienced by the northern and central army groups. Beyond that loomed the prospect of total defeat. Chapter 14. Faces of Occupation, 1942-1943. The Soviet Union. In July 1941, 2nd Lieutenant Helmut H. of the 258th Infantry Division recorded how his men, and presumably he himself, reacted when told they were being pulled out of the line for occupation duty in newly conquered Belarusian territory. Yesterday, a minor mutiny flared up over the surprise news that we're to remain in this area as occupation troops. All they want is to push on into the Russian interior and share in the spoils. You get the impression that the men are just burning to get to grips with the enemy. His attitude to the people he was occupying and to how to treat them was shared by many of his fellow officers. The following month he likened the occupied population to pack animals. Yesterday I decided to put an end to the malodorous laziness of these cart horses. With the help of Caucasus Germans, I explained to the few male inhabitants still left that all inhabitants were to have a pay cut. These people are as thick as sin and deserve no other government than the one they just had. I will ensure that the harvest is brought in this village. Maybe violence will help. The core period of German military administration in the occupied Soviet Union was between early 1942, when it became clear that the German army would be in the east for a much longer haul than it had expected, and the summer of 1943. After that point, the occupation unraveled as the Germans were pushed back westwards. The army's main challenge during this period was to overcome not just the enormous practical obstacles of occupation, but also its own harsh, short-sighted view of eastern peoples. Ultimately, it failed on the first count and only partly succeeded on the second. In a sense, the Army's occupation administrations, primarily the three Army Group rear areas and the various Army rear areas, performed their role more effectively than did the civilian administrations in the more westerly Reich commissariats. The German occupation of the Soviet Union was beset by destructive rivalries between the Office of the Four-Year Plan, the Wehrmacht, the SS, and the ineffectual Ministry for the Eastern Occupied Territories. But while these rivalries certainly afflicted the Army's administration of its own rear areas, the effect was less debilitating than in the Reich commissariats. This allowed senior army administrators more freedom to place their occupation on a more sensible, sustainable footing, if with only partial success. But rivalries still beset the army administration, and many of its administrators lacked political foresight. The occupiers' failures were also caused by the sheer scale of the problems they faced, the insufficient forces they commanded, and their often self-defeatingly ruthless and rapacious conduct. By the autumn of 1941, some German army commanders and administrators were already devoting more thought to the question of how to maintain order and stability in the occupied territories and thus make them viable for sustained economic exploitation. Even Manstein's notorious General Order of November 1941 stressed, "Voluntary cooperation in the rebuilding of the occupied countries is absolutely necessary to the achievement of our economic and political aims. The just treatment of all non-Bolshevik sections of the population, some of whom have fought heroically against Bolshevism, is a prerequisite. A more constructive occupation policy, which sought to co-opt the population rather than simply terrorize it, was therefore essential. But as Second Lieutenant H's outbursts of the summer of 1941 demonstrated, German officers in the East felt that same reluctance to assume occupation duties that characterized the German army as a whole. In some ways, the army's administration of former Russian territory was to prove relatively enlightened. However, like the army's administrators in the occupied East during the First World War, it also considered this territory and its peoples backward and uncivilized. Indeed, this bedrock of prejudice was what made many officers and soldiers more receptive to the Nazis' particularly virulent brand of anti-Slavism. Moreover, the practical means at the army administration's disposal in the occupied Soviet Union fell short of what was needed. This was apparent at every level. The commanders of the Army Group rear areas and smaller army rear areas were men in their 50s and 60s who had imbibed the national conservative worldview of Imperial Germany. This did not make them Nazis. However, as anti-Slavism was part of their worldview, it did not automatically make them particularly far-sighted either. For example, General Karl von Rock, who commanded the Army Group South rear area, viewed the Russians as cultureless. He ascribed to himself a hard but fair colonial mentality, but put more stress on the former quality, arguing that the population must be treated ruthlessly if it was to serve the military occupation's needs. Below them was a stratum of staff officers, and the commandants of the various Feldkommandanturen and smaller Ortskommandanturen. The majority were in their 40s and would have experienced, and perhaps been hardened by, frontline service during the First World War. More than 80% were reservists, less well-trained than their full-time professional colleagues. Many came from those middle-class circles to which the Nazis had long appealed. While it is not clear how many were members of the Nazi Party, a great many were members of the SA. This did not automatically mean they would all make poor administrators, but it does suggest they would be too dogmatic in their dealings with Eastern civilians. Lieutenant Emmerich P. served with Ortskommandantur 351, 2, in the jurisdiction of the 285th Security Division in the Army Group North rear area. His own anti-Russian attitude comes through in a letter of 13 July 1942. "An hour ago, I had a typical Russian experience. A senior doctor in the village hospital came with his Feldwebel and complained there was no power in the hospital. When the Russian machinist arrived, he said with the most naive face in the world that he thought that because today was a big holiday, no power was needed. Such stupidity is undreamt of." This case also signifies what a good job the Soviets clearly did of transferring their competent personnel further east before the Germans' arrival. Another important group of officers belonged to Section 7 Administration, one of which was allocated to each Army Group rear area, Army rear area, and Security Division. These were civilians in uniform rather than soldiers, appointed for their expertise in areas such as economics. Most were between 35 and 50 years old, and had received only basic military training before heading east. Temperamentally and professionally, then, this body of officers might be prepared for the tasks of military occupation in some respects, but not in others. For their part, frontline troops frequently despised full-time occupation personnel as Etappenschweine, rear area swine, leading a safe and comfortable existence while the real war was fought further east. Thus did Valdo P. of the 5th Light Infantry Division describe Riga in March 1942. "There's a soldiers' theatre there, at least 5 soldiers' cinemas, etc. Also, one sees in cafes and restaurants signs like, 'Entry only for officers and Wehrmacht officials. Daily dances here. We never see such things at the front.'" Severe shortages in lower-level administration and in security forces did not help either. Because of the paucity of their own administrative personnel, the Germans came